Ambassador Zippy Hotobly, escorted flower in hand by her security detail to her car as British police ward off peaceful pro-Palestine protesters earlier this week. Hotobly, a fervent opponent of Palestinian statehood, had been controversially invited by the London School of Economics Student Union to a debate on Middle East peace. As she emerged from the debate, she was met with students and pro-Palestine activists exercising their democratic right to protest. But there was a problem with that. It was a peaceful protest against the ambassador of one of Britain's closest allies with powerful pressure groups in British politics. That has meant a torrent of criticism and condemnation from the pro-Israel media and government ministers. From the British Foreign Secretary, who has called the protest unacceptable, to the Home Secretary, who has described it as disgusting and anti-Semitic.
What is the evidence for this? People were opposing the Israeli policy, at one, and secondly, this particular ambassador, who actually says there is no such a thing as Palestinians. Every inch of the land belongs to the Israelis. So by that definition means that this is encouragement to ethnic cleansing.
Once again, an expression of solidarity for Palestinians portrayed as anti-Semitism. One of the targets of that labeling, the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission himself, who spent a lifetime calling out the Israeli regime's repressive apartheid against Palestinians.
What do? They actually try to be sort of racist towards others, use the only tool that they could possibly use of saying anti-Semitic, and then sort of trying mud at everybody else who's trying to stand up for justice and say, this is standard, this type of person should not be given a voice. If you look at genocide and ethnic cleansing, it always starts by denying people of their right to live where they are living.
It's a curious thing about freedom of speech and of expression in the UK. While it's free against some, it's restricted against others. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister for Political Affairs and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bakhari Khani, visited London for high-level talks ahead of upcoming negotiations in the Austrian capital that have stalled since June of 2021. It was the first official visit of a high-ranking Iranian diplomat to the UK Foreign Office in some time.
I met with a number of UK foreign ministry officials today. We had comprehensive discussions on bilateral relations, regional issues, and also future negotiations.
The long and complicated history between Tehran and London means there are always matters up for discussion. But topping the agenda this time around are the sanctions removal talks due at the end of the month. The Islamic Republic has underlined its position as not simply a return to the negotiating table, rehashing previously decided matters.
The main purpose of these talks from the Islamic Republic of Iran's standpoint is to lift the illegal sanctions imposed on the Iranian nation by the U.S. government in blatant violation of the JCPOA and the blatant violation of U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231.
Having been in Europe for the better part of a week, relaying the Iranian perspective was paramount.
I've had good conversations with the political officials of France, Germany, and the UK in the past 3 days. At the same time as being straightforward and serious, those conversations were clear and progressive. I shared our perspective on the necessary framework for the upcoming talks in an unequivocal and very transparent manner.
Iran has already stated its willingness to deliver a good agreement, but that might hinge on the willingness of the remaining parties to honor the existing terms and walk back the failed maximum pressure campaign initiated by Washington after their unilateral withdrawal back in 2018. More will be clear when all the parties meet on November the 29th. Amina Taylor, London.
Hezbollah Secretary General stressed that the resistance in Lebanon has prevented full U.S. hegemony over Lebanon and has prevented civil war. underlining the achievements of the resistance, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that one of the most tangible results is the fact that Israel is deterred from launching aggressions and even fears the strength of the resistance.
For the first time, Israel is living in a deeply rooted state of fear and concern for its existence. The elites in this entity are asking about the legitimacy of the entity's existence and the ability to exist. They are trying to get some oxygen through normalization of ties with some Arab states, but deep in their minds, the Israelis know that all these countries cannot protect their occupation or forts from the men of the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the entire region.
Speaking at Hezbollah's Martyr Day celebration, Nasrallah said the main fear for the Israelis is that the resistance in Lebanon would invade the Galilee in northern occupied Palestine. Sayyid Nasrallah also criticized the Saudi campaign against Lebanon, saying a sovereign state would not accept any foreign dictates. The real problem is the crisis the Saudis have in Yemen, he said. The only way to stop it is to accept a ceasefire and lift the siege. Representatives of Lebanese political factions consider that the sacrifices of the martyrs of the resistance in Lebanon are evident for the entire region.
This is a historic day, not just for the resistance in Lebanon, but also for all the people from the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon to Palestine. Had it not been for the martyrs, the entire region would have been destroyed. The Zionists and the Takfiris are the same, supported by the U.S. and Arab regimes. But we believe this sacred blood will liberate Palestine.
Families of the martyrs, for their part, stress that they would not back down.
The blood of our sons bore fruit, and we cannot back down now despite all the campaigns against us. Our children and grandchildren will continue to sacrifice their lives.
Sayyid Nasrallah also reiterated that as the resistance liberated Lebanon from Israeli occupation, their next goal is full sovereignty and freedom from U.S. hegemony.
What began with the first martyrdom operation in November 1982 as a fight for freedom from Israeli occupation in Lebanon has transformed into a struggle for emancipation for the entire region. And what used to be a grassroots resistance in a small Mediterranean country is now backed by an alliance on a regional scale, ready to face new U.S.-Israeli threats. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
This was the first visit by Afghan interim foreign minister to Pakistan. The fact Pakistan provided its plane to Amir Khan Muttaqi highlights the precarious economic situation the Afghan government is facing at the moment. Muttaqi met Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan, who assured all-out support to the people of Afghanistan in the wake of worsening humanitarian and economic crisis.
There are a number of issues which Pakistan and the Afghan government, especially the Taliban regime, they will be talking about, particularly engaging with the world. And you know, Taliban are ready to get engaged with the world.
The visit of the Afghan interim foreign minister was coincided with a meeting of top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States. Known as Trika Plus, the special envoys of these four countries discussed the current Afghan situation. They also met the Afghan interim foreign minister.
This was the first time that top diplomats from Pakistan, Russia, China, and the United States together held talks with the Afghan interim foreign minister. Amir Khan Muttaqi was informed about the expectations of the international community from the Taliban government.
A joint statement issued by the Trika Plus reminded the Taliban of its promises they made with the international community. The Afghan foreign minister was told that the Taliban need to form more inclusive and representative government. At the same time, the Taliban government was reminded of its commitment to cut ties with all terrorist groups. But Pakistan, Russia, China, and the U.S. favor engagement with the Taliban government.
We believe Taliban are interested in engagement as they seek international acceptance and support. It is therefore crucial that the international community avoids repeating mistakes of the past and continues with positive engagement.
The four countries expressed deep concern over the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan and promised to extend all possible help, while the U.S. has refused to unfreeze $9.5 billion Afghan central bank assets. But there is no indication if any of the country is willing to recognize the Taliban government yet. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
scores of surveillance bunkers, checkpoints, and frequent frisking of residents and vehicles have made life difficult in Indian-administered Kashmir. Following the deadly October violence in and around Indian-administered Kashmir, New Delhi has tightened security in the region. More than 20,000 paramilitary forces, CRPF, and some 5,000 border security forces, BSF, have been called into action. The paramilitaries have occupied locations in the residential areas, a move that has raised concerns among the residents.
It's a serious life threat to all of us. The entire neighborhood will collapse if any sort of unexpected incident happens.
Authorities say these measures are taken to avoid further civilian deaths.
Forces have been in Kashmir since 1947. The only reason to call the additional forces sometimes is to make Kashmir secure for its residents. Bunkers are constructed against potential terrorist acts. Last month, around a dozen civilians were killed. The presence of forces will therefore ensure a sense of security among the residents.
However, residents complain about the humiliating and disrespectful behavior of the security forces.
In Gujarat, authorities should accommodate or relocate the entire neighborhood. The presence of troops around our homes has made us gripped. Not only this, the usual frisking on roads is also disturbing our mental peace, and we are often being humiliated. The entire population is looked at through the prism of terrorism and terrorists.
Kashmir is the world's largest militarized zone and the longest pending dispute. India and Pakistan have fought wars over the territory since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. The two countries rule the region in parts but claim it in full.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, New Delhi promised equality to the people of Kashmir. Analysts say 2 years on, people of Kashmir have instead developed a deeper sense of insecurity and alienation. And so far, New Delhi has done least to address their grievances. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. U.S. has inflicted heavy damage on Iran over the past 3 years due to its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal. The United States must apologize, compensate the losses, and compensate for Iran's lack of benefit from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. We now present you an article written by Abdulreza Hadizadeh. The piece is titled, Why Does Iran Say We Do Not Have Nuclear Negotiations? The first step in any negotiations is that the participants must share common views on the issues that will be discussed. The main topic takes center stage and viewpoints on its resolution will be put to consultation by the countries participating in the negotiations. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his deputy Ali Bagherikani are seeking to build a common understanding about the nature of future discussions with the 4+1 group through making trips and phone calls with their counterparts. In this regard, the Islamic Republic of Iran stresses that it will not participate in any talks revolving around the nuclear issue and that the country's nuclear program will not be the topic of any future negotiations. But what is the reason for such a position in the talks, which are set to start on 29th of November? The case of negotiations related to Iran's nuclear issue was closed in 2015, and the parties achieved significant results. In the course of the talks leading up to the nuclear deal between Iran and the 5+1 group, the Islamic Republic of Iran faced unsubstantiated and political allegations. The country had also been subjected to attacks and questions that led it to be unjustly accused by Western media. Therefore, Iran had to build the necessary trust to show its goodwill and seriousness. So Iran made large-scale retreats in the field of peaceful nuclear energy before the lifting of sanctions. This issue was strongly challenged inside the country. Critics of the agreement in Iran raised the question of why the Zionist regime is engaged in non-peaceful nuclear activities without being a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. While Iran is not supported by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, and even punished in some way despite its membership of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, an extensive cooperation with the United Nations Atomic Watchdog, the IAEA. The negotiations reached a conclusion, and all countries were obliged to honor their commitments based on a specific timetable. According to the nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the International Atomic Energy Agency was responsible for verifying Iran's practical measures at its nuclear sites. Later, in 16 reports, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, confirmed Iran's goodwill and the Islamic Republic of Iran's full implementation of the nuclear agreement. These verification reports proved that Iran's nuclear issue was only a political case brought by the country's enemies and rivals. Iran's full commitment to the nuclear restrictions took place while the administration of former U.S. President Barack Obama violated the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action through various sanctions and pressures. After that, the unilateral and illegal withdrawal of Barack Obama's successor, Donald Trump, from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action completed the unfinished work of the Democrats, and thus the United States practically violated an international agreement as well as the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. Other JCPOA members either failed to provide Iran with the economic benefits of the deal or, like the three European countries, sided with America. Hence, the United States and the European states are accused of reneging on their obligations. After the U.S. pullout from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, the Islamic Republic of Iran exercised more than 2 years of strategic patience to prevent the collapse of the nuclear pact. Then Iran decided, in accordance with Articles 36 and 37 of the nuclear deal, to expand its peaceful nuclear activities and take reciprocal measures in the face of the blatant violation of the agreement. The difference between the political actions of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States of America was that Washington, through its withdrawal from the JCPOA, breached the international agreement and violated the UN Security Council Resolution 2231. While Tehran expanded its nuclear activities, according to the mechanisms and methods in the agreement itself, to reaffirm its commitment to the failed deal. However, according to opinion polls, the U.S. government's measures seriously damaged and weakened the nuclear deal and significantly increased the Iranian people's distrust towards Washington. Investigation into one JCPOA signatory's violation of its commitments is now the subject of the talks, and other axes of the negotiations will be formed around it, the most important of which are as follows. 1. The Islamic Republic of Iran will by no means renegotiate its previously negotiated nuclear issues. Other subjects such as missiles and regional issues will also be off the agenda of the talks. 2. If the U.S. government allows itself to completely change its policy towards international obligations after the change of each government, it must give the new Iranian government the right to at least oppose part of the Vienna talks under the previous administration and call for the beginning of new negotiations. And 3, the U.S. government's unilateral and illegal move has made the high wall of mistrust between Iran and America stronger and more stable. If current U.S. officials regard as wrong the path pursued in the past administration and they regret it, they should take confidence-building measures right now. Unfortunately, so far, despite U.S. President Joe Biden's criticisms of his predecessor Donald Trump, policies towards the nuclear deal, and Iran has not seen any serious change in this regard. Hours after taking office, Joe Biden issued 17 executive orders to annul the previous administration's decisions, but regarding Iran, Biden continued Donald Trump's legacy and strategy. This matter intensified the need for U.S. to build trust. And 4, the U.S. has inflicted heavy damage on Iran over the past 3 years due to its unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal. The United States must apologize, compensate for the losses, and compensate for Iran's lack of benefit from the JCPOA. 5, following confidence-building measures, the United States must completely fulfill its obligations under the JCPOA. It must remove visa bans as well as Iran's Sanctions Act, the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act, and more than 1,500 sanctions imposed on our country by the U.S. government since its signing of the JCPOA. 6. Iran should have ample time to verify the normalization of its trade and the transfer of currency into the country. 7. The United States must commit itself not to violate its obligations with the change of government in the country. Additionally, due to the growing distrust towards the United States, its ability to trigger the snapback mechanism should be blocked and locked. And 8, with the lifting of sanctions and the compensation for damage inflicted on Iran, along with America's commitment not to renege on its obligations again, Iran can take steps to return to the restrictions imposed under the JCPOA, and thus the nuclear deal can be revived. Moreover, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says Tehran and the remaining parties to the landmark nuclear deal of 2015 can reach a good agreement in a short period of time, only in case of a serious and positive approach to the upcoming talks slated to start in the Austrian capital Vienna at the end of this month. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said in a post on Instagram recently, "The Islamic Republic has no intention to be locked in the stalemate remaining from the previous negotiations. I believe that if the opposite side enters in the Vienna talks with a serious and positive approach, it will be possible to achieve a good agreement in a short amount of time." The top Iranian diplomat said it was necessary to once again outline Iran's stance and views about the sanctions removal talks in Vienna, as the date of the negotiations has been finalized. He noted that he held detailed and separate phone calls with the foreign ministers of the 5+1 group countries, that is China, Russia, Britain, Germany and France, recently, and emphasized that the Islamic Republic of Iran would pursue a result-oriented approach to the talks and is determined to achieve a good agreement. Amir Abdollahian emphasized that achieving a good agreement calls for the effective and verifiable removal of sanctions and the return of the opposite side to their full obligations according to the nuclear deal. He said Washington's behavior, including in imposing new sanctions against Iran, has made the provision of its objective guarantees an unavoidable necessity. The Iranian foreign minister noted that his deputy and the country's chief negotiator, Ali Bagherikani, held explicit and useful talks in European capitals in recent days. Hossein Amir Abdollahian further said, "As I have repeatedly emphasized, the administration of the Islamic Republic of Iran will continue the policy on the expansion of balanced ties with countries based on mutual respect and common interests. With seriousness, and is determined not to tie the improvement of bilateral and multilateral economic cooperation to the issue of the JCPOA."
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. For more than 6.5 years have passed since Saudi Arabia initiated its onslaught on the Yemeni people, a violent bombing campaign of the infrastructure as well as civilian areas caused an extensive amount of damage, and more importantly, it caused the loss of so many lives. However, the tide has changed as the Yemeni army currently has the upper hand and is now on the verge of taking over the oil-rich city of Ma'arib. Is defeat near for the Saudis and all of their allies from the Persian Gulf to the West? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on The Spotlight. I'm going to start this discussion off crossing over to Sana'a, talking to Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Abdul Latif, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the latest situation on the ground there.
Thank you so much. Actually, the Yemeni army managed to liberate the Al-Falaj area. The Saudi coalition has a military checkpoint in that area, and so many travelers have been or have got kidnapped in that military point. It is the eastern gate to Ma'arib. The Yemeni army managed to liberate this area, and this is an important point for the Yemeni army, and important advantage for the Yemeni army to keep encircling the city and liberate the city from the Taliban concerned, also from the terrorist group, actually, the leader of the Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khalid al-Atrafi, admitted that they have been fighting alongside the Taliban forces in 11 military fronts, including Marriott. He said that their participation is insistent, and no one can deny that. And this admission refutes the allegations of the Taliban forces and the Taliban coalition that they are not using terrorists to fight Yemeni army. Yemen's armed forces have been saying that for 7 years, that they are not fighting only the invaders, but also the terrorist groups, which in Marib or in Al Bayda or Taiz or Hudayda or the front across the country. In Al Hudayda, the Emirati forces have suddenly withdrawn their forces from so many areas, and I believe that they will continue their withdrawal to lift the city for the Yemeni army to control the city. Military experts say that this withdrawal comes in the process of gathering the forces to protect the Bab al-Mandab state and also to protect the south of Yemen, as the Yemeni army is liberating Marib just a matter of time, and they want to lift Marib and think about what will be after the falling of Marib in the hands of the Yemeni army.
All right, thanks so much. That was our update out of Sana'a from our correspondent on the ground there, Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Now I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, historian and journalist Brett Yockers out of Hausat, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in Hausat with Brett. As time goes on, why does it appear to be more difficult for the Saudis to inflict defeat on the Yemeni army?
I think the main reason for this is that the Saudis have gone to war with much the same strategy as their overlord, so to say, the Americans, and the Israelis have always been doing. That is the shock and awe strategy, the idea that by overwhelming them with military hardware, with military prowess and power, by a massive display of what you can field in battle, that will overwhelm the enemy in to such an extent that they will completely collapse, that their morale will collapse, and you can basically take over the country in a matter of weeks. That's the idea, the strategy, the doctrine that is behind a lot of the invasions that the United States has waged in the past 20 years. It is the strategy behind what the Israelis are doing in Palestine for decades now. And it's the same doctrine that the Saudis have been trying to use. Unfortunately for them, the shock and awe doctrine is completely and utterly useless against a nation that is united in a common cause, because you cannot defeat a country with military hardware alone, especially if that military hardware, like the Saudis and the Americans and the Zionists, when that military hardware is specifically aimed at air superiority, and that is what we have seen for so long already. One of the first things that the Saudis did when they attacked Yemen is almost completely destroy the Yemeni Air Force, and that's why up until this point, the Yemeni Air Force is nearly non-existent indeed. They still, the Yemeni Air Force as a unit still exists, but they majority field drones and other unmanned aerial vehicles. They don't have any airplanes. So Saudi Arabia still maintains air superiority, just like the Americans have done when they invaded Afghanistan, when they invaded Iraq, and still like what the Zionists have over Palestine right now. But the problem is, you cannot defeat a country like that. You cannot win a war just by bombing alone. You can win battles, you can advance rapidly, but you cannot maintain. And that is exactly what has been happening here. The Saudis have been overwhelming the Yemenis in the beginning of this war, have been advancing many, many hundreds of kilometers into Yemeni land, but they have not been able to really capture large territory of, like, large population centers, especially in the north and in the west, where the population of Yemen is majority local.
So was it, let me just jump in here, was it a total miscalculation? Let me throw this, let me cross over to London and say it, Mohsen. How do you see it? Was there a total miscalculation going into this to begin with by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, by their those who support them, like the Americans and the Brits?
I think there was a huge miscalculation. I mean, they called it the Operation Decisive Storm, precisely because they thought that it would be all done and dusted within 3 or 4 weeks. That's exactly what bin Salman, who initiated this this war, thought, what he intended. Of course, that comes as a complete shock to them that it it hasn't worked out that way. The American intelligence has obviously failed on this. The Zionist intelligence has failed on this in terms of giving the Saudis insufficient reports on what the Yemeni morale was, what the Ansarullah's morale was, what their capabilities were. Those capabilities, of course, have grown rapidly during the war since 2015. But at that time, clearly they got some very, very bad intelligence. And what actually has transpired is that the Saudis have now spent in excess of $300 billion on a war against almost the poorest, if not the poorest, nation on the Arab Peninsula. And in return, they've really failed in every target that they had. In fact, the reverse has happened. The Yemeni Ansarullah forces have not only held them up till 2018, but actually in 2018 turned the tables on them and actually went for the jugular, went on the offensive. And that offensive is absolutely mind-boggling, because the equipment of the Yemenis, the tactics of the Yemenis, the strategies of fighting, etc., have been absolutely amazing and a real kind of eye-opener for any military.
What do you think has been key in that, Sayed Mohsen? I mean, you talked about the offensive and how they have turned the tables. I mean, what has been key in that, being able to turn the tables, even though you just pointed out rightfully it's totally inequitable if we compare the type of equipment that both sides have?
Well, number one, the Yemenis have a huge faith. This is really not to be underestimated. Their spiritual and religious commitment to anti-oppression, towards the anti against tyranny, against the Saudis' tyranny, of course, but also the Zionist tyranny, was totally, I think, underestimated by their enemies. The tactics that they've employed have been unique, insofar as they haven't gone out and fought like a standard army, if you like. They've not really battled in those formations that you'd expect. And what they've done is they've employed methods of hit and run, methods in which small groups of small units have gone in, done the operations, and then disappeared into the sand almost. And I mean, that's perplexed and totally bamboozled a Saudi military which was armed to the teeth with missiles and all the latest hardware. How do you fight an army which can disappear not only into the desert, underground, overground, wherever, or even into the towns and villages? You're basically fighting the people. So where are you going to find these forces to fight? Not only that, they've actually demoralized a mercenary army, because the Saudis didn't want a boots-on-the-ground situation. Because the air power failed, what they did was started to import mercenaries from Sudan, Somalia, other places. So these mercenaries that they're fighting are not dedicated to any cause or commitment, whereas the Ansarullah are fighting for their families, for their children, for their nation. There are many differences to this this virtual victory, I see.
Okay, well, Brett, tell us the importance of what is happening right now, because we know about the situation in Marib and the offensive and every day having more and more victories. The importance of capturing Marib.
We have to bear in mind that Marib is the last and only major stronghold that the Saudis and their supporters still have in central and central northern Yemen. Except for Marib, their entire stronghold, their entire foothold in Yemen is almost entirely concentrated in the thinly populated, be it strategically located, south and east of Yemen, which is very sparsely populated, which is not a very well-developed area when compared to the more populated areas that are still under control of the National Salvation Government and protected by Ansar Allah and their allies. So when Marib falls, this will be a very massive blow, not just militarily, but also economically and spiritually, mentally, for the Saudis and their allies. We already know, of course, that the Saudis, when it comes to Yemen itself, to Yemeni troops, the few Yemenis that are fighting on their side are for the majority members of the Islam Party, the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan movement in Yemen. And we know that within the Islam Party, there is a growing rift that has started, especially in Marib, in which some groups of the Islam Party are thinking of negotiating and have already even offered certain venues of negotiations that so far, unfortunately, have not yet led to a capitulation of the city. But it is definitely a start. And one of the reasons for that being is that the National Salvation Government still to this very day offers a general amnesty to every mercenary, every Yemeni who joined the Saudi forces, who decides to defect, put down the weapons or hand in their weapons, and decides to return back to civilian life. That is perfectly still, or that venue is still open. So aside from that loss of a major Islam Party stronghold, the potential loss of the last vestige of northern and central Yemeni power that the Saudis still have, there is the massive economic importance in terms of oil and gas. Not so much necessarily that the Saudis need the oil, but the oil is now at least kept out of Yemeni hands. That is their goal. Try to keep the country as poor as you can be. If that oil were to go back into Yemeni hands, and Yemen could possibly, potentially in the near future, negotiate further economical oil deals with other countries, if the government in Sana'a could somehow manage to sell that oil on the international market again, this is a massive influx of funds again that belongs to Yemen, but so far has been kept out of Yemen for almost 7 years now. So when all these things come together, and we have to bear in mind that at this point it's not only in Marib, but also the east coast areas have been liberated at a rapid pace. Just today there was a report that the Kilo 16 area, which is the major road between Sana'a and Hodeidah, mm-hmm. has been liberated and has been reopened after 3 years of Emirati blockade. The Emiratis have retreated. The Yemenis have moved back in, and the road, the direct routes between the major cities of Sana'a and the major port city of Hodeidah, both of them who are in hands of the National Salvation Government, that road is open again now. There is a direct line of transportation from the port to Sana'a. All these things taken together represent a complete and total breakdown of Saudi and Emirati stranglehold in central Yemen, which means that they will have to withdraw almost completely to the south, to Aden and to Hadramaut.
Okay. Well, said Moussa, let's look at the Saudi allies, such as the United States and Britain. Both countries had discussed the need to curtail sales of further military equipment to Saudi Arabia, but we've seen the opposite. The Biden administration has recently approved $500 million more. Why do both these Western countries continue to show their hypocritical policies when it comes to Yemen? On the one hand, it says that the violence must cease and civilians should not be killed. On the other hand, we see that they continue to support the Saudi regime.
Well, the entire strategy and policy of, Zionist exceptionalism across the world, and of course the domination of that region and the plunder of the resources of that region, has relied fundamentally on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been the one that has been buying a lot of the nations around that region with its dollars, persuading them, maintaining a status quo, making sure that they didn't rebel against the Zion-American order in that region. So Saudi Arabia has been a linchpin, really, for Anglo-Zionist policy and imperialism in that region, keeping all of the nations to heel. Of course, the reality is that the situation is changing. The resistance axis has fundamentally changed the dynamics in this region. For the relevance of Yemen, of course, whilst it was under the Saudi yoke, Yemen was not allowed to access its nickel, gold, copper, cobalt. You know, the oil and gas fields have been mentioned, but there's been a huge amount of wealth which has been suppressed by the Saudis. They've not allowed the Yemeni rulers who were their puppets to unearth any of those. You've also got this entire situation, for instance, with the outcome of the current situation changing the face of West Asia, potentially. What happens in Marib is no small thing. It could literally change the face of West Asian geopolitics and geoeconomics. Firstly, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait leads straight to the Suez, so that immediately hits Israel and Egypt. If the Ansarullah were to take control of that entire strait, it would cause huge problems for the likes of Israel and Egypt in their strategies and policies. It would be a win-win for the likes of China and the Islamic Republic of Iran, who would essentially have a major ally on the Arabian Peninsula, a diehard ally in a way. But this has been hard won. The 13 out of 14 districts that have been now defeated or brought under control by the Ansarullah have come at a cost of many, many lives. But they are now at the point where only the city itself is running free, and they have maybe one base, a Saudi base in the region, which is there, which will very likely easily be overcome.
Okay.
80% now, if this happens, 80% of the Yemeni population will be governed by Ansarullah. That is huge. And they, as my colleagues stated earlier, they control the water and the oil of the nation, which actually will boost, give a morale boost to the entire resistance movement there, if you like. So it's no mean feat. If this actually goes through, even the likes of the United Arab Emirates, who control the ports down in the south currently, and who nurture Al-Qaeda, ISIS types in their midst, all will be under a huge, if you like, a decision-making process they'll have to go to, because already Dubai and Abu Dhabi have been threatened by drones and missiles by the Ansarullah, but they haven't gone for their jugular. The Saudis have tasted that threat very, very consistently, but it remains to be seen that if UAE is turned on, how long they would even stay around in the south once it falls.
All right. Well, Brett, a former Trump official, David Schechner, has said that the U.S. must prepare itself for the Saudis losing in Yemen. What does this mean exactly? I mean, on the one hand, is it that Washington actually realizes that the Yemeni army and people will be victorious soon? And on the other hand, if it does realize that, why then does it continue to support what Riyadh is doing?
I think we must not underestimate, of course, the power of what is called the war hawks in the United States, both in the Pentagon, in the White House, in the State Department, and in the House of Representatives in the United States. There is a massive support base of both the typical neoconservative war hawks, as well as the war hawks on the liberal side, and of course, something that must never be forgotten, the Zionist lobby, which has a massive influence, unfortunately, still to this day, in the United States policies. And you see with people like starting in with Obama and continuing under Trump, and now as well continuing under Joe Biden, that on both sides of the aisle, be they Democrat or Republican, you have those people who are diehard, dyed-in-the-wool supporters of the Zionist project, who are backed by the Zionist lobby, who are bought and in the pocket of the lobbies of the military arms industry. And Joe Biden is most definitely a very good example of a quote-unquote progressive liberal war hawk, because he has been in the pocket of these lobbies since decades already, so this should not be surprising. Of course, what we do see now is that there are more and more. Recently, there were 30 senators just a few days ago who in the U.S. Senate have proposed a total ban on supporting Saudi Arabia. These are people who have seen that there is no point in supporting this war any longer because their defeat is already certain. And these are people who most likely are not considered, have not been bribed yet, or are not considered important enough by the lobby to necessarily buy them. The interesting thing is that both Trump and Joe Biden, when they were running for president, they both of them agreed and promised to their electorate and were elected partially by people who wanted to stop supporting Saudi Arabia. They both promised that, both from a Republican and a Democratic point of view, that they would stop supporting Saudi Arabia. Of course, the moment they get elected, they have completely withdrawn that promise and done the absolute opposite. Because again, you know, these lobbies that are at work behind the scenes. But when you see now that how the situation is going now, I think the United States will have, and that is what this former advisor of Trump's, I think, is getting at, the United States will have to come to terms with the fact that there is no future for this war to go their way. It is as good as impossible that the Saudis will win this in a normal military way. And in order, of course, to pull as much as they can out of the fire, let's say, from the U.S. perspective, they will have to pressure Saudi Arabia to negotiate. They will have to pretend that it was not the United States' doing, but it was more like, you know, a mistake made in Riyadh and by Riyadh alone, because they don't want to happen what my colleague here said. They don't. Americans, of course, don't want Yemen to really completely go on the bandwagon of the axis of resistance. They don't want Yemen to be an ally of Iran, an ally of China, of Russia, and of the axis of resistance of Palestine, of course, in general. So they will probably try to somehow get in Yemen's good graces again in order to try to deviate the goals of the revolution.
Okay. Let me just get said, Mohsen, in 30 seconds. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Brett. Just 30 seconds, said Mohsen. You heard what Brett said, that this would probably what they would try to do. Do you think that they would be successful in actually then trying to negotiate with the Yemenis and trying to prevent, as Brett had said, basically this major support or expansion of support of the resistance? How is your assessment of what's going to happen? 30 seconds. I know it's not a lot of time, but I know you can do it.
Well, very simply, no. The Americans have lost faith and trust. And not only that, let's not forget the Ansarullah have an ideological base. That ideological base is anti-tyranny, anti-imperialism. They will not drop their guard. I think if they would come to power, they will be a fair, just government, but they will not kowtow to the Israelis or to the Americans, nor will they cut deals with them.
I'd like to thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. The historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hausa, and journalist and political commentator Syed Mohsen Abbas out of London. And as always, we're